This week on The Right Side, Catherine McKenna defends the export of coal while condemning the U.S. for using it. Alberta's carbon tax adds 75% to the cost of natural gas. A university debate on pronouns leaves free speech in jeopardy. And the federal government wants to reintegrate ISIS fighters into Canada. This is The Right Side, episode 44, recorded Saturday, November 25th, 2017. The Problem with Priorities. Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side this week. Patrick and myself are back, as we are every week here in Canada. And yes, you guys can listen to us around the world if you're interested in Canadian news. Welcome to The Right Side.
Yeah, and the Americans had their Thanksgiving on Thursday, and I believe a lot of people in North America had Black Friday yesterday. So, but amidst all the shopping, there's been a lot of news and a lot of political discourse that has happened, which we, of course, try to do here at The Right Side. And if you're just joining us for the first time, The Right Side, of course, is a podcast where we try and cut through all the bias and sensationalism that is present in the mainstream media, and where we try and talk about a lot of the discussions and articles and topics that don't really get either covered at all or covered fairly in the media.
That's right. And that's what we do each and every week here. And we're heavy on Canada this week, but that's fine. If you guys want to follow along, we have full show notes available for our notes and the links to our sources at rightsidenews.ca. And I think that takes us nicely into a Canada story regarding energy. So take it away.
Yeah, so the Environment and Climate Change Minister, Catherine McKenna, she's back in the news again this week. And we know from previous stories it's usually because she said or done something controversial in regards to energy, industry, or business, and how that impacts the environment. And over the past few weeks, she's been in Bonn, Germany at the 2017 UN Climate Change Conference, where she allied with her British counterpart, Claire Perry, to launch an international alliance to phase out coal-fired electricity, which of course signaled a sharp contrast to U.S. President Donald Trump's promotion of coal as an important global energy source. And she actually rebuked the Donald Trump's push to revive the coal power industry. And she said that while doing so, she said that the federal government has no plans to shutter Canada's coal exports. She said, quote, "They have got it wrong. We share a border with the U.S., but air doesn't know any boundaries. Water doesn't know any boundaries." She was saying this in an interview with Evan Solomon, who is the host of CTV's Question Period. So in Canada, four provinces still depend on coal for electricity: Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. McKenna said that she is working with these provinces to wean them off, although there are still approximately 42,000 Canadian jobs in the coal industry. When she was asked by Evan Solomon if her department had a plan to help these workers, McKenna swiftly changed the subject by saying there are more workers in renewable energy and that there will be a transition. And then she started talking about the environmental impacts of coal and how those communities want cleaner air. She mentioned that when Ontario switched to clean electricity, they went from 40 smog days in Toronto down to zero. So when Solomon questioned her further, saying that when the transition happened, thousands of workers lost their jobs and energy prices spiked, and he asked if there was a plan to mitigate that, McKenna deflected some more, saying that Canada has a great opportunity to do something good here. So in an interview in her Parliament Hill office, McKenna said that the Liberal government is not only committed to meeting its Paris target of cutting GHG emissions by 30% below 2005 levels by 2030, she says it'll actually go further and adopt a more ambitious target in the coming years under a ratcheting provision set out in the Paris Accord. Since concluding a federal-provincial climate deal last December, Ottawa has announced a ream of planned policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but it has yet to introduce the bulk of the legislation or regulations to implement them. And most of the planned spending won't come for another year or two. Now, carbon pricing legislation, which we've talked about before, will also be introduced early in the new year and will require all provinces to meet a minimum federal standard of a carbon tax or see Ottawa implement its own carbon tax in their jurisdiction. And the federal plan to reduce methane emissions in the oil and gas industry is due to be released soon, even as Alberta is expected to release its own draft regulations in the coming days. Now, Conservative Party MP Ed Fest argues that the Liberals are piling on climate change costs, including carbon taxes, at the risk of the country's industrial competitiveness. He said that Canada cannot get too far out of line with its major trading partners, such as the United States, particularly at a time when Mr. Trump is pursuing a pro-business agenda. And also related to this story, Nicaragua and Syria joined the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, and Nicaragua and Syria were the final two countries to sign on to the climate accord, leaving the U.S. as the only UN member state not supporting the agreement. McKenna's official department Twitter tweeted out a congratulations that read, quote, Canada salutes Nicaragua and Syria for joining on to the Paris Agreement, global hashtag climate action.
Exclamation point,
of course. So the tweet was soon deleted, and McKenna took responsibility, saying that the tweet was, quote, completely unacceptable. And Conservative leader Andrew Scheer called the Syria tweet, quote, unfortunate. I don't think it reflects well in the department. Certainly not something I think Canadians want to see, government officials congratulating countries led by dictators.
And that sums up the hypocrisy of this whole story and the numerous bullet points right there. The government is willing to congratulate Syria on joining this climate change deal, but is unwilling to pursue an economic-based business agenda that will synergize nicely with our biggest trading partner, the United States, to ensure good jobs for Canadians.
And not only that, but there's seemingly not a plan to help the workers that are currently in the coal industry in Canada. And if there would be a plan to have them retrained or transition them into other jobs in similar industries, or how they would mitigate the rising energy costs that are going to happen due to all this plan transition and moving over to what they call cleaner energy.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of transition is one thing, but in general, transitioning is not just a simple matter of flicking a switch and, you know, changing your education and changing the field you're in. There is no reason at this point to throw away all of these jobs that deal with coal and that form of industry in Canada, because like it or not, renewable energy is great when it works, but what is going to be the backup in all these jurisdictions if there isn't enough power? Coal can produce that power reliably, and if one province isn't producing enough power to meet their demand on a very hot day or a very cold day, they bring it in from out of province where it's being produced reliably in some other way. So it doesn't make sense to be throwing all these jobs away at this point, just for the fact that I think in this case the government wants to pursue its own ideological agenda here.
Right. And with Canada's population continuing to grow and grow with every coming year, we're going to have more increased demand for energy as well. And we've already seen in BC there's been opposition to the Site C Dam project, which would provide a whole boatload of new energy sources for the province. And there's been a lot of opposition to that. And that's hydroelectric power. So I'm not sure where a lot of these governments think that the energy is just going to come from.
Are they going
to
start talking about nuclear next?
Yeah, and where are we going to get the energy if we don't actually have enough? I mean, the only thing that we can actually do is source it from the United States.
Right.
Well, guess what? They've got less clean energy than we do when it comes to all their coal.
And that happens
in
Ontario.
And then we'd have to pay more for it.
And that happens in Ontario, too. And that's how you get people in Ontario with the administration of a carbon tax combined with having to import this energy and, in general, recoup all of the green energy costs in Ontario. That's how you get these multi-hundreds of dollars of electricity bills in Ontario. And, you know, that is a story that's not told enough. And it looks all shiny and green when you're talking about green energy and whatnot. But when it comes down to it, coal is cheap, coal works, and 42,000 jobs. That's not a drop in the bucket. That's something that needs to be considered very heavily. And, you know, just like many other times we've seen in the past 2 years, this is just a recurring theme of what happens with this government. It is a government that doesn't seem to be taking note of its consequences and what they do.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you kind of hit it on the head earlier when you said that it's not something that just happens overnight. When you're trying to transition away from this, you have to build the energy projects, which costs a lot of money. You have to retrain the workers, which takes a lot of time and money as well. And then you have to set up the infrastructure for that.
And you need a good investment climate
really
to bring that in.
Yeah. And you see in cases where Puerto Rico, they're trying to rebuild their entire energy grid after the devastating hurricanes that they've had this past summer. And they're finding out that it's a lot of money to do so. And that's something that they would have to do if they completely shifted all of their, if Canada shifted all of its energy sources away from coal and into renewables. It would cost a lot of money, and that wouldn't be something that the government's going to really pay for. Inevitably, it's going to be every taxpayer that's going to pay
collateral
for
damage.
Not just through their home heating bills or their hydroelectric bills or electricity bills, however you say it, but it's also going to happen through taxes as well. That'll go through the taxes, and you're going to end up paying more both ways. And that's something that also really should be taken into account here. And I don't really think they're talking about that very
right.
much.
Right. And I mean, we got to give credit to Question Period for asking this question. It doesn't seem like there was an appropriate answer given, and it was just danced around. But I think Ed Fast also said it quite well regarding this, that it comes down to business competitiveness. Where is the business going to go? They're going to go take the path of least resistance, just like water does. So,
and I think that's something that's been noted as well. And a lot of the time when the Liberal ministers, they go and talk to the media and the media is asking them questions, they actually take the same stance that they do in Question Period when the Conservatives and the NDP are asking them questions in the House of Commons. Basically, they bring up their own prepared script, and sometimes they won't even talk about what the topic's about. And they will just kind of go on their own platitudes. And what I got from watching the interview and watching that is that she was basically in House of Commons Question Period mode, and she was trying to dance around a lot of the issues. And that's something that I think a lot of people are noticing that the Trudeau Liberals are doing lately, in that they are not really talking about the topics. They're trying to go based on the broader theme of it. And I think that's a tactic that might backfire them on them later on, because
it's going to backfire when they have to answer real questions at some point.
Exactly, especially when people, like, as they call them, real Canadians, start asking them questions about things when it comes to taxes or electric bills. I know there were that Trudeau was grilled on that in a town hall last year during the election. So it's going to be something that's, I think, going to be an issue in the next upcoming election.
Yep,
for sure.
It's a nail right on the head. We're going to keep the page here on taxes, and specifically carbon tax, except this time move to Alberta. Alberta has had a carbon tax in place since January of 2017, and that's going to go up again on January 1st of 2018. The carbon tax itself is set to increase by 50% at that point, increasing from $20 to $30 per ton on basket emissions. So that's just general carbon pricing if you are as part of a member of industry, that you need to pay the government that amount per ton that you emit as per your emission calculations. But as we all know, that trickles down to everyone else in the economy, right? So it includes pretty much any form of fuel that you can think of. Diesel, which of course is used for trucking and trains, that's increasing by 2.68 cents per liter. Gas that you use in your car is going to be increasing by 2.24 cents a liter, making the carbon tax on gas a grand total of 6.73 cents per liter. And natural gas, the carbon tax on natural gas, is increasing by 50 cents per gigajoule. And that's where our story begins here this week in Alberta. So the total cost of the carbon tax on natural gas prior to January 1st of 2018 right now is $1.01 per gigajoule. The January 1st, 2018 hike brings us up to roughly $1.50 per gigajoule, so an extra 50 cents, give or take, on this. The PAC, or Political Action Committee, as we discussed in previous episodes, known as Alberta Can't Wait, tweeted an infographic highlighting a 75% tax on natural gas. Those were the exact words they used. The infographic ultimately goes further to highlight that anyone who uses natural gas will see their heating bill go up by 75%. Now, you might think that, you know, they say it's a 75% tax on natural gas. And yes, that is what it is at this current point right now. And the reason for this is that the price of natural gas before the carbon tax is roughly $2 per gigajoule. So if you factor in the carbon tax, that will bring it up to roughly $3.50 per gigajoule. And if you do some simple math right there, that is a 75% increase on natural gas prices due to the carbon tax from the base price of roughly $2 per gigajoule. So just a little bit of information here for the record. The current carbon tax on natural gas means that gas comes in at roughly $3 per gigajoule. And that right now, if you look at the numbers of what natural gas costs and what the carbon tax is, that equates to a 50% increase of the price of natural gas due to the carbon tax. Now, you might say, okay, so this is just a little image that was posted on social media and circulated among people who might dislike the carbon tax and might be supporters of the United Conservative Party. Well, with this image, the media and government went into full damage control mode. The government calls these claims made in this infographic patently false. And the reason they're saying this, that it's patently false, is because the infographic says it's a 75% tax on natural gas. But in reality, the infographic actually says that it's a 75% increase on the price of natural gas. They do say at some point that there is that this is a tax on natural gas, which is true. Though I think the way it was interpreted in wider circles is that this is a total 75% tax on natural gas. But in reality, what the media has done here is something what I call pretzel twisting, twisting themselves into a position to make their claims true. So this story was in the Edmonton Journal, and they outright admit that natural gas prices are going up. I think everyone can see that in their heating bills here in Alberta. Just look at the price this November compared to last November, and you'll see what the differences are based on the carbon tax and various other factors. Energy prices are going up. So where this leads us is that there's a highlight that is done in this article by the Edmonton Journal highlighting the dollar amounts, and they even admit that it is a 75% increase on natural gas, which is also what the infographic says. But no, according to the Edmonton Journal and most of the media, the infographic is just plain wrong, dead wrong. The technicality that the media and government in lockstep here are highlighting that makes this patently false is that the carbon tax price would be roughly $1.50 if the natural gas price was $2 per gigajoule as it is today, or $15 per gigajoule if it was to raise that much. So that is the technicality that the government and the media is using here, is that no, you can't call this a 75% tax on natural gas. Let's just call it a 75% increase on natural gas instead, because the carbon tax on natural gas is a fixed value come January 1st, 2018 of roughly $1.50 per gigajoule. So while Alberta Can't Wait and the United Conservative Party have a valid point that makes sense, the government calls it patently false, and the media, of course, goes out of their way to defend the government on this by a round of pretzel twisting, or if you'd prefer, obtuse circular logic, in that, okay, it's a technicality. It's word art at this point. They're basically saying we have a 75% increase in natural gas, but we can't call it a 75% tax on natural gas, all because of the technicality that the $1.50 you're paying in terms of the carbon tax per each gigajoule on natural gas is fixed. So you know, you yeah. see this, and it kind of makes you scratch your head as to why the media went so far to refute these claims. But in reality, the numbers add up.
And not only that, but it makes me scratch my head as to why they'd be, you know, focusing on this specific issue when it comes down to it. I think when you look at the bigger picture, there's a lot more of consumption of natural gas just over the past 10 years than there has been with coal. In fact, just how we link our two topics together, coal consumption has actually gone down at the exact same, almost the exact same rate that natural gas consumption has gone up. And I think it's fairly clear is that natural gas is actually what we would call a more cleaner fossil fuel than coal is. And a lot more people have been using it because it's been less expensive and less harmful for the environment. And a lot of people make that choice based on that. So what they're doing here is they're actually making it more expensive to use the better alternative to coal. And they're trying to hit consumers both ways. So basically, they're trying to say, well, we're going to tax you if you use coal, but we'll also tax you if you use natural gas. Basically, your only option is to, you know, buy your own solar panels for, you know, thousands of dollars and whatnot.
Yeah, and that's so. What ultimately comes into play here with carbon taxes is that they are ways to try and force a population to change their behavior. But you really can't do that in Alberta, given the fact that we are at such a far northern latitude that the amount of sun that we get in the winter, it doesn't make sense to use solar. And if you were to retrofit your house with solar technology, that's also a very expensive option at the point here when everyone can have cheap fuel with coal-powered electricity and natural gas for home heating. So we're effectively being forced to change our way of living with this when there isn't exactly a cheaper, more efficient alternative out there at this point. And just to see the media jump to the government's aid on this should give everyone a moment of pause and remember this, that, you know, if we do happen to be in an election campaign this spring, or as more likely in 2019 as anticipated, you need to remember stories like this where the media jumps right in and ultimately will come to the side of the government aiding them in selling the point that what was posted online is actually wrong. But as we said here, the numbers add up, because if you have $2 and you do a 75% increase on that, you're seeing an increase to $3.50. So
yeah, I think that's simple math. And what's more worrisome than the media taking the government's point is the fact that these journalists can't seem to do proper math to begin with. And that's something that should not only worry people that watch the media, but also people in business that actually, you know, that their lives are actually and their livelihoods are dependent on this.
I mean, according to this headline, patently false, you would expect a breakdown of how this works. But I think it was the second or third paragraph in the story, it outright admits that prices are going to go up, and it is in the magnitude of 75%. So you can't call something like that patently false if in the third paragraph you're going to say it's true. So,
yeah, it's kind of funny, actually, just how they say how it's patently false. They try to explain how it would be, and then they actually just say, oh, that just means that it's increasing by this much, and that's what it is.
It's a technicality. It's not going.
It's basically they're running off a technicality, and that's how you know that they have no leg to stand on, right?
Indeed. All right, so what do we got for our second Canada story?
All right, so our second Canada story is actually a kind of a shocking story that made the rounds on national media, and it came from Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo. So Lindsay Shepherd, who is a grad student and teaching assistant, showed a video in a tutorial for a communications class, and she was teaching the class, and it was on the debate surrounding the use of gender-neutral pronouns. And the video showed was an episode of the TV Ontario Current Affairs program called The Agenda, and it showed a panel discussion that included two University of Toronto instructors. One was Nicholas Matt, who is a lecturer in the Sexual Diversity Studies program, and the other was controversial psychology professor Jordan Peterson. Now, Jordan Peterson has become infamous for his opposition to being required to use gender-neutral pronouns, and he has described them as an expression of a radical left-wing ideology. And he's been quite famous in the media recently for his views. So Shepherd, after the class, was then sanctioned by her supervising professor for showing the video. She covertly recorded her meeting with her supervising professor, Dr. Nathan Rambukana, as well as another professor, Herbert Pimlott, and the manager of Gendered Violence Prevention and Support, Adria Jewell. And this week, that audio, she actually released it to media outlets. So Shepherd was told that one or more students complained about the video, but she wasn't told what the complaint actually was or how many had complained due to privacy concerns. Rambukana told Shepherd that showing the video without denouncing Peterson's views was like, quote, neutrally playing a speech by Hitler, and basically not denouncing Hitler for it. She was also told that by showing the video, it was, quote, creating a safe unsafe learning environment and toxic climate for her students. Rambukana then said that the topic is not up for intellectual debate, as the pronouns were protected by the charter, and that's of course false. And he actually suggested that she was breaking Canadian law by showing a video in class. Joel then mentioned that Shepherd had violated the gendered and sexual violence policy of the campus. When Shepherd questioned as to how she violated it, Joel said that Shepherd was, quote, causing harm to trans students by bringing their identities as invalid or their pronouns as potentially invalid. So Shepherd, who was quite distraught at this point, under a lot of stress from the three-on-one there, she rightly said, so me showing a YouTube video for a debate makes me transphobic and I caused harm and violence? I can't do anything about that. Rambukana then asked, so that's not something you see an issue with? He also mentioned that this topic at all shouldn't be talked about or debated because the students were, quote, too young to have the critical toolkit to pick it apart. Oh my goodness, isn't this
people over 18 here, aren't we?
Oh yeah, these are people that are at least 18 years of old. They are adults basically, and they at this point in their life should have the critical toolkit to pick apart debate. And if not, I mean, this is what school's for, is to teach you how to do that, right? So anyways, on Wednesday, the issue was raised in the House of Commons as opposition leader Andrew Scheer made it the first question of the day. He said, quote, will the Prime Minister join me in condemning the egregious crackdown on free speech at Laurier University? So Scheer has been known for his stance on defending free speech in post-secondary institutions, and one of the things that he campaigned upon when he was running for leader of the Conservatives was taking away funding for those institutions that don't defend free speech. Scheer actually called the meeting that Shepherd had with her professor a, quote, inquisition, and that he said he couldn't believe what he heard. Debate is not only supposed to be allowed at university, it's to be encouraged, he said. Quote, I think that it's extremely disappointing that the administration at that university would proceed in that way. I believe it's part of a larger concern that I've witnessed and seen and heard feedback from students and from faculty around the country that there are more and more impediments to free speech on campus. Now, the Prime Minister was in Toronto at that time, so Scheer's question was answered in the House by Minister of Science Kirsty Duncan. She wrote from a prepared speech and said, quote, our government is committed to creating open spaces for Canadians to debate and express their views. In a free society, we may disagree with people's views, but we must defend their right to hold them unless those views promote hate. Intolerance and hate have no place in Canadian society or in our post-secondary institutions, Duncan said. So you see what I said earlier about when they're talking about a prepared speech, they're kind of going on the broader views and they're not actually
it's happening
talking
here
about,
too.
It's happening here too, right? It's amazing how many of the ministers have this prepared sort of way of speaking when they're talking about an issue. It's almost like they're trying to offend as few people as possible, and they're not trying to take a side. Now, on Tuesday, after this was all leaked, Wilfrid Laurier University's president, Deborah McLatchley, issued an apology on behalf of the school to Shepherd. She said, quote, "After listening to this recording, an apology is in order. The conversation I heard does not reflect the values and practices to which Laurier aspires. I'm sorry it occurred in the way that it did, and I regret the impact it had on Lindsay Shepherd." Now, in his apology, Rambukkana acknowledges that he mishandled the meeting and said that his main concern was, quote, "finding out why a lesson on writing skills had become a political discussion and making sure that harm didn't befall students." He said that he failed to provide Shepherd with the support that she deserved in such a meeting with faculty members. Quote, "I should have seen how a meeting with a panel of three people would be an intimidating situation and not invite a productive discussion," he said. He also apologized for his choice of words during the meeting. Quote, "Perhaps instead of the route I took, I should have added further discussion in lecture or supplementary readings," he wrote. "But instead, I tried to make a point about the need to contextualize difficult material and drew on the example of playing a speech by Hitler to do it. This was obviously a poorly chosen example. I meant to use it to drive home a point about context by saying here was material that would definitely need to be contextualized rather than presented neutrally. And instead I implied that Dr. Peterson is like Hitler, which is untrue and was never my intention." Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't really sound like someone that's sorry about it or making an apology.
There's some more pretzel twisting.
Exactly, right? So Shepherd told CBC News that she doesn't see where the university had any other option but to apologize. This was their only option, she said, adding that, quote, "I didn't expect their apology to be sincere. I don't think that they are sincere." Shepherd said that the issue is far from over, considering Laurier is continuing with its third-party investigation into what happened, and that a task force is looking into how the university can foster, quote, "important discussions in a thoughtful and determined way." Shepherd says that she's not clear what that actually means or what that would actually do. She said, quote, "While they did do damage control because they were profoundly embarrassed, it doesn't really guarantee anything for the future if anyone ever finds themselves in my situation. It's kind of unfortunate that they didn't make any long-term commitments to protecting the ability to debate topics in the classroom in the future." And she also said that the outpouring of support, including offers to crowdfund her, which she's turned down, has been heartening and shows how much people care about freedom of speech, even if much of the support came from people with different political views than her own. She said, quote, "Obviously, the vast majority are right-wing, and that's fine," she said. "But my question is, why doesn't it matter for people like me who are left-wing or left-leaning, but still believe in being reasonable? As she's noted multiple times, she doesn't even agree with Peterson's stance on pronouns. If someone told me that they have a pronoun that they like to use, I would just use it," she said. So at this point, you'd think this would be the end of the story, but there's actually something wackier going on at Wilfrid Laurier. A Tuesday statement by Wilfrid Laurier University's Rainbow Center appears to endorse a policy of silencing all mention of the debate on gender-neutral pronouns. Quote, "In the face of recent media attention, we feel it is our responsibility to speak out against the climate of transphobia that is being fostered at Laurier," reads a statement released Tuesday by the Rainbow Center, which is a service within the school's Diversity and Equity Office that offers support to queer and trans students. The quote, the statement reads further, quote, "The discourse of freedom of speech is being used to cover over the underlying reality of transphobia that is so deeply ingrained into our contemporary political context. Articles and columns written in support of Shepherd were described as being, quote, defending and perpetuating transphobic beliefs and attitudes." And the statement suggests that the debate of gendered pronouns is, quote, "disallowable speech that constitutes a form of epistemic violence that dehumanizes trans people by denying the validity of trans experience." Oh my goodness, isn't this something? It's hard to almost read through it just because of how different it is, you know?
I was a little concerned that production of this podcast had been hijacked and this had been replaced with this week's firing line, with how absurd this is.
It almost is, isn't it? It's just something that's so out there. And for the university's professors to be taking such a hardline stance on this sort of thing, it makes me think, I'm really glad that she secretly recorded this conversation. Otherwise, you can bet that it would be swept under the rug, right?
Yeah, definitely. And you know what's also really, really absurd and, you know, saddening at the same time is that the university is behaving exactly the same way that this government would behave, by dancing around these various issues and trying to move everyone on to the next big issue at this case. And, you know, as much as I think the university administration would like that to happen, I don't think that's going to happen. Because, you know, as she said, that she's not finished yet with this. And there was also the statement by the Rainbow Center, which took the condemnation a step further as well. So this is definitely something we're going to need to watch out for. But I never thought I would say this, but it's a very frightening look into what can happen on university campuses in this day and age. So,
yeah, and it's not over yet, because Shepherd's actually mentioned how she's actually basically been blacklisted from the other teaching assistants in her program. She said that none of them want to even talk to her now, and she said that it's basically made her out to be a monster. And she says she's not really a monster. I mean, she's just a typical teaching assistant.
Showed a video.
She basically showed a video. She didn't even agree with the video, but she said, this is what people debate on. And honestly, I think I congratulate her for showing a different side of it and showing something about a debate, on which I think that schools are even there for that, because I think that schools, in a way, they're meant to teach you about certain topics, and they're not supposed to force their opinion on you. They're just supposed to show both sides and say, this is what some people believe. This is what other people believe.
Let's talk about it.
How do you feel about it? What's your opinion? Let's talk about it. That's what they're there to do.
Yeah.
They're not meant to force an opinion down. And that's something that this university doesn't seem to agree with.
Yeah. And, you know, you can have actual debates in science-based programs, because you can test those hypotheses in a science-based program and have them proven false, no matter how outrageous they might be. You know, that even extends to some of the other hybrid studies, like economics as well. That can be proven with numbers there, and people are free to debate. But when you come into this into these kind of programs here, there is really no outright way to prove these things. So it needs to be an open debate where both sides can present the arguments, and the validity of both of them needs to be held up, and whichever one reigns supreme at the end of the day, the other needs to be respected as well, which isn't happening in this case. So
yeah, when it comes to things like science and math, you can prove theories and hypotheses through the scientific method. But when it comes to topics like this, where it's not numbers and equations, but feelings and emotions and language, it's a lot harder to prove one way or another. And I think that's where the debate reads, and that is where opinions start forming, because as we know, opinions aren't facts. And that's something that needs to be talked about in these schools. And I think for a communications class, Rambukana was mentioning that he didn't know why this was talked about in a first year communications writing class. But I think when it comes down to it, I think a first year writing class, it's there to show you how to communicate with other people. And how do you communicate with other people without knowing about different topics that people might want to talk about? And by being able to debate those topics in a civil way, without having the skills to know about it. So I think that's something that the students actually do need to know. And he doesn't seem to think that that's something that's important, but honestly, I think it is.
It is very important. And you know, that's also why we're doing the show, because this is a perspective that the media doesn't really talk about, and they skip over sometimes as well. So, All right. So if you thought that was firing line, the real firing line is up right now, though that could have substituted in quite nicely. Headline this week for firing line is Canada concerned about returning ISIS fighters, Justin Trudeau says, but he's not concerned in the way that we all think. We're going to start plain and simple with the facts for this story. 180 Canadians have gone to fight for ISIS. These are Canadians that have rejected the peaceful Western life that Canada provides for them, and instead they favor radical Islamic ideology that's bent on taking over the world. The Prime Minister, once again speaking from a script, answering a question from Andrew Scheer, the opposition leader, offered up that the government, quote, takes the protection of Canadians very seriously. One returned individual may have national security implications, Justin Trudeau said. The government will be there to help them let go of their terrorist ideology, he followed up with. And following from this, it took repeated questioning from the Conservative opposition bench until Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale eventually revealed that 60 fighters have returned to Canada and that they are under, quote, very careful investigation. 60 out of 180 have come back to Canada for some reason or another.
That's one third, in case the journalists in the crowd don't know math like they did earlier, right?
Thank you. And that is 33% as well, since we were talking about percentages in the Alberta story.
Indeed.
So the government's response to this is ultimately that when it comes to the safety of Canada, our intelligence agencies and the RCMP do an adequate job in protecting Canada from terrorist threats. Which, when you think about it, people might also be doubting that after our story last week regarding the Edmonton terrorist attack. And when possible for cases to be made, those ISIS criminals are, quote, prosecuted within the fullest extent of the law, Ralph Goodale says. So if there's a possible case for one of the people who has come back, they will be prosecuted within the fullest extent of the law. And this leaves out, of course, the very big question here that these people have come back, but they're just integrated into Canadian society right as soon as they get back. So that leads into the actual issue with this story. And the issue is not that 60 ISIS fighters have returned to Canada. It's that rather than sending these people to prison, the Prime Minister and his government is setting up a program to help them de-radicalize to the extent of this quote here, that it will, quote, help to ensure that resources are in place to facilitate disengagement from violent ideologies. The question being asked by many, and one that many Canadians will also have, is why do we want them a part of our common society after they totally rejected what we stand for by going to fight for ISIS? Now, the media doesn't show this unless there is a Westerner taken hostage by ISIS, but we need to remember that ISIS is effectively a group of barbarians. They behead their prisoners. They've also taken this barbarism one step further, and they have drowned and burned prisoners in cages. They also throw gays off buildings just for the simple fact that they're gay. So ask yourself, your family, and everyone around you, would you want people who have supported this ideology in the past within your community? Probably not. Trudeau's plan in the work, or Trudeau's plan that's being built here and the way it's going to work in theory, is that it relies on one huge assumption. And that assumption is that we know who these people are and that we also know where they are. But the plan falls entirely apart if we don't know who they are and we don't know where they are, because then there would be no way to check their progress, and they will ultimately have a free pass into Canada just like the rest of us. So, unfortunately for all of Canada, this is the worst-case scenario that's come to fruition here. Public Safety Canada says that it can't provide any statistics on the success of Trudeau's program because it doesn't directly intervene with radicalized Canadians who have returned. So, therefore, the plan that the government has laid out isn't working because they aren't interacting with these people who have come back. And there's no way to check on them if they're not interacting with them. So therefore, the plan is completely broken. Public Safety Canada's, quote, Canada's Centre for Community Engagement and Prevention of Violence is currently undertaking 6, quote, action-oriented research projects, and there are also 4 more planned under the category of direct intervention or prevention programming, but no details are given anywhere of what this means. Of these 4 projects, 2 are training programs for the Ontario Provincial Police, a 3rd backs a series of expert roundtables on the use of social media, and the 4th, called Project Someone, takes place in Montreal at Concordia University, which, quote, promotes the use of social media and art in schools to build awareness and resilience. Project Someone has received $367,000 in Canada, or rather in September, from the Canadian government. So while these research projects are underway, with what appears to be zero potential for direct intervention with the returning ISIS fighters, former CSIS officer Phil Gursky is troubled by this mixing of counterterrorism and de-radicalization. And from this, I think we can all conclude that the government has a serious problem with the returning ISIS fighters, because even the CBC has called it de-radicalization through poetry and podcasts.
Oh man, doesn't that just sum everything up there, eh?
It really does. The fact that the CBC is calling it de-radicalization through poetry and podcast, a former CSIS officer has legitimate concerns with mixing of counterterrorism and de-radicalization, and none of the theoretical plans to interact with these people who have come back are interacting with them when they're all predicated on interaction with the people who have come back in order to make them work. That's a serious problem. So
yeah,
they are free to go fight and kill Westerners and just come back. And everyone should ask themselves the absurdity of this and say, what would happen in World War II if someone defected to the German or Japanese side and wanted to come back to Canada while the war was still going on?
Very likely they wouldn't be allowed back, and then they would probably, if they were, they would be taken in as enemy combatants and jailed, probably, at least until the war was over. And definitely there wouldn't be something talking about them integrating into Canadian society and trying to help them let go of their ideology. Now, this is something that's really worrisome, because it's something that the Conservatives have been talking about on and on in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
But has the media really been talking that much about it as much as they should have? I don't really think so. They've not really mentioned very much about it. There's been like a story here or there, but it's not really been on the same scope of as what it should be, because this is a really serious threat that these ISIS fighters could be in our communities as we speak, and we don't know what's going on.
We don't know where they are. They could be in BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, anywhere in Canada they could be. And just look at the trouble that one person caused in October 2014 in the Parliament Hill attack. There's 60 of those potential targets out there right mm-hmm. now in Canada. And
as we've talked about on previous episodes as well, there are people out there in Canada that sympathize with ISIS and would probably love nothing more than to get together with these ISIS fighters for the experience that they've had to try and plan something. Like we talked about the former one that was arrested for his Facebook posts, and he was talking about all the targets that he had on Facebook and all the ones that he thought were good places for ISIS to hit. And there are people like this in Canada, and we don't know how many of them are out there. We hope that CSIS and our counterterrorism agencies are aware of this and that the RCMP is doing its due diligence, but we don't know for sure. So I don't think that exacerbating this problem is such a good idea at all.
Yeah, and I mean, if this was to be talked about and, you know, talked about in a meaningful way, you can guarantee that at some point someone would be called racist. And, you know, to the Conservatives' credit here, they did talk about this in a meaningful way from the sense of public safety and question period. Unfortunately, that response and what was actually happening with this story and the sheer numbers of it didn't make it to the news cycle. And, you know, you would think that if there were this many people running around Canada with no way of tracking them down, that this would be a major source story and perhaps something that required investigative journalism on. But as far as I can tell, there is no drive to do that in the mainstream media. So,
yeah, I definitely agree there. And I think that the fact that they think that this will work, it really just shows the priorities of the government on this issue. And they're not... It doesn't seem like they're that much concerned with the public safety when they're trying to reintegrate them by letting them go of their ideology and de-radicalize them.
They're definitely having some problem with their priorities there.
Indeed. But after all, we know that it's not easy to make priorities, right?
Indeed. So I think we can move on to Word of the Week. And for Word of the Week this week, we got percent, which is an adverb. And the definition of this is by a specified amount in or for every 100. Example being new car sales may be down by 19% or staff rejected a 1.8% increase. Now, of course, the reason we chose this is for the 75% increase on gas prices, natural gas prices in Alberta, and, you know, just the mere technicality we talked about there, but also the fact that we have roughly one third of people who went to go fight for ISIS returning to Canada. And you can visualize percentages in the form of a pie, and one third is a very huge chunk of that pie. So that is definitely something to be worried about. And that's why percent is our word of the week, because everything this week seemed to deal with percentages. So we're going to be watching a lot more about these 75% natural gas increase and the one third of ISIS fighters who have come back.
And not only that, but also the Paris target of cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2030, and whether that's an achievable goal for Canada, who is an energy exporter. So that's something that we'll have to look at, and that's why percent is our word of the week.
Thank you.
All right. So with that, I believe that ends the show off for us this week. So if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at rightsidenews.ca. If you're interested in the podcast, you can also subscribe to us on iTunes at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes or /YouTube if you want to listen to us through there as well. And you can also find us on social media at twitter.com/rightsideca or facebook.com/rightsideca, where we're going to be posting a lot of the articles that we can't actually have time to talk about on the podcast. And we'll be talking about a lot of different news articles on there, and a lot of from all different sources of the media. And a lot on there will be a lot of topics that maybe you didn't get covered very fairly as well. So if you want to engage with us, you can go there for sure. And with that, I believe that ends off this week's episode.
That it does, and we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side. Take care, everyone.